Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This is Eat Sleep Work Repeat. I'm Bruce Daisley, the podcast about workplace culture, psychology, and life. The next run of episodes is just going to be me. It was great to get wider perspectives, and I loved working with Ellen and Matt. But some of the feedback was that people felt that the three of us talking just ended up making the episodes feel less substantial, certainly in comparison to interview episodes. And logistically, with everyone having full-time jobs, it was really hard to arrange the three of us plus a guest, especially quite often at short notice. Today's guest, for example, was something that was offered to me, and I had to drop things to accommodate. So it's just really difficult to do that. So much love to the brilliant Matt and Ellen. I'd love to have them back for maybe occasional discussions and episodes as time goes on. Now, onto today's episode. Communication is one of the biggest issues when it comes to workplace culture and workplace dynamics. If we look at the Gallup Workplace Survey, one of the things that characterizes it is the relationship between people and their managers, workers and their managers. It informs whether people think that they've got a good job, whether people have got an intention to stay, whether they're engaged in their job. And all of these things are a direct consequence of how we communicate. It's why I was so thrilled to get the opportunity to go and chat to Charles Duhigg. You've probably potentially own a book by Charles Duhigg. His bestseller, The Power of Habit, is one of the perennial bestsellers, and you can find it regularly at the top of the book charts. He's gone on and he's written a new book, Super Communicators, which really tries to unpack and systematically analyze how we communicate, how we try to build connections, communication relationships with others. It's an absolutely spectacular book. It's a really great read. It will impact your personal life, but almost certainly will impact your work life. And so I was thrilled to head along to the publisher that I share with Charles. I headed along to the offices of Penguin Random House to have a chat with him and talk about his new book. Here's my chat with Charles Duhigg.
My name is Charles Duhigg. I'm a reporter at the New Yorker magazine. And I also write books. And I wrote a book a number of years ago called The Power of Habit. And I have a new book named Super Communicators. It's just out.
It's very rare that a book includes the degree of vulnerability that you include in this book.
Oh, thank you.
Because you mention that actually, albeit that we know how important communication is, this is something that isn't always in our wheelhouse. And you mention at the end of the book that actually you felt like when you'd been gifted the opportunity to be a manager, you'd struggle with these things.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really caught me off guard because, you know, I've had managers my whole life, and I actually went to Harvard Business School and got an MBA. And so when they made me a manager, I figured, oh, I'd be great at this. And I was okay at the logistics and the, you know, the strategy. It was the communication with my direct reports that where I really fell down. I had trouble looking back on it, hearing what they were trying to tell me, and I had trouble understanding what they needed from me.
I saw a famous quotation that I often return to, which maybe didn't make its way across the Atlantic. It's by a sort of British philosopher and playwright called George Bernard Shaw. And he says, the biggest problem with communication is the illusion that it took place.
Yeah, right.
And what it strikes me about a lot of communication is that
to some extent, we seem to be sort of communication averse now more than ever before. I'll give you one example. I was talking to one organization last week, and they said to me that all of their meetings, all of their, and you know, on average, organizations are spending 20 hours a week on meetings. All of their meetings are with cameras off. Huh. And it just struck me that even the intent of communication had been diluted by that. What do you think about the state of communication? Are we becoming more communication averse?
I think that we're living through a period where communication is getting harder. And we've forgotten some of what we know about communication. You know, it used to be that you had classes in school where you actually learned communication skills, right? In the 1950s, our parents, when they were in school, would have gotten a home economics course or an interpersonal relationships course. And as schools became more technical, that dropped out. And so as a result, I think one of the things that's happened is that we've stopped teaching people about communication, and we've stopped teaching them that they need to think about communication. But the truth of the matter is that we have all evolved to be fantastic communicators, right? Communication has always been Homo sapiens' superpower. It is the thing that has allowed us to do better than every other species because we can build families and then villages and then towns. We can share knowledge with each other without having to experience that knowledge. And this is really, really valuable. And our brains are evolved to be really good at communication. However, obviously, we evolved in a very different time, right? Not only was it pre-Twitter and pre-social media, it was pre-computers and it was pre-telephones. And so sometimes it's easy to forget what we ought to know about communication until we have an opportunity just to remind ourselves of some basic skills and some basic principles. And once we do, our brain will make those into habits very, very quickly.
I read the book about a month ago, and I returned to it earlier this week. And actually, I applied something that I used, and it was immensely satisfying. So one of the things, I think broadly, when there's a lull in conversation, the way that we get out of it is some of us are questioners and some of us are monologuers. We talk. And I'm definitely a questioner. And I've found, I was out to lunch 2 weeks ago. I was just found myself in that succession of just asking questions that were getting dull answers. Right. And a couple of days ago, I started using one of the approaches in the book, which is trying to avoid the shallows and heading into deeper topics. And it was an immensely satisfying conversation for both of us. And I'd love you to just explain the idea behind that.
Yeah.
So this idea of sort of getting out of shallow conversation and plunging into something. Talk us through the thinking behind that.
Yeah. So, and you're exactly right. A lot of it has to do with questions because we know that we should ask questions of other people, right? But what sometimes we don't recognize is that some questions are more powerful than others. And these powerful questions are usually known as deep questions. And a deep question asks you about your values or your beliefs or your experiences, which can sound a little intimidating, right? It can sound like that's a kind of a deep conversation, but it's actually much easier than it sounds. If you bump into someone who is a doctor, you know, a shallow question would be, where do you practice medicine? But a deep question would be, oh, what made you decide to go to medical school? What do you love about being a doctor? Right? Those aren't overly intrusive questions. They don't seem overly personal. But what they do is they invite the other person to talk a little bit about what they care about, how they see themselves, what the experiences and the values are that brought them to this line of work and why it has meaning for them. And once somebody does that, it's very natural for us to answer our own question and say, oh, you became a doctor because you saw your dad get sick? It's funny, I actually became a barrister because I saw my uncle get arrested and I wanted to help fight for the little guy. And I think that this is one of the things that we've learned is much easier to do than people think it is, which is to ask deep questions. And when we ask deep questions, oftentimes we invite the other person to say something meaningful about themselves. And it's very natural for us to answer that same question ourselves, or it's very natural for them to ask us something that allows us to reveal who we are. And at that point, you're having a real conversation.
I'm really intrigued with the application of this because one of the things I've seen from organizations over the course of the last 4 years is that people have said something that's actually manifested in the data, which is there's fewer and fewer of our team members saying that they've got friendships here, that they feel connected to each other. I think 40% of all workers say they don't have a single friend at work. And this sense of gradual disconnection, this sense of work becoming a degree more transactional is probably something that not only impacts organizations, but it also makes all of our lives harder and more
Absolutely.
Isolated. And it just struck me that understanding how you can ask these questions that aren't probing but seem invested seems to be a really critical thing. This idea of asking about beliefs, values and emotions seems to be a really critical thing if it's done well. And I guess, you know, I'd just ask another sense of how would you advise someone to do this well?
I think one way to think about asking deep questions is to think of it in terms of this. Instead of asking someone about the facts of their life, ask them how they feel about their life, right? It's very easy to ask about the facts. Those are the most obvious things that occur to us. You know, where do you work? Where do you live? But a deeper question is just a little bit different. It says, like, what do you love about where you work? What's your favorite thing about where you live? When we ask a question like that, it does not seem overly intrusive. But what it does is it gives the other person a chance to say something that could potentially be vulnerable. And vulnerability is kind of an interesting concept because we tend to think of vulnerability as like, you know, I'm crying on your shoulder, I'm showing a weakness. But vulnerability is actually just saying something that someone else might judge. Now, you might not care how they judged it. You might not care at all. But by saying, oh, the thing I love about my neighborhood is we have such a strong community there. What we're doing is we're putting ourselves in a position where someone else could say, oh, yeah, you have a strong community. That doesn't seem like a good read. Like, property values are much more important than a strong community. By saying something vulnerable, by exposing a vulnerability, what we do is we make an invitation to the other person. Because if they respond with a vulnerability of their own, if they say something like, oh, your community is like why you love your neighborhood, that's funny because like that's how I chose the job that I work at. Is I just felt like these people were just people I liked hanging out with.
And do you think that reciprocation is an important part of the building?
It's critical.
Right,
it's absolutely critical.
So if you just find yourself in a succession of asking questions, no matter how emotionally engaging they are for the other person, it might just feel like they're being interviewed. You need a bit of this sort of looping back.
That's exactly right. The difference between interviewing someone and having a conversation with someone is this reciprocation, right? If interviews are great. You do interviews.
Yeah.
In an interview, you oftentimes ask questions and the person says something interesting and you ask a follow-up question. But a conversation is us both participating, both bringing something to the table. So I ask you a question, you say something interesting, and then I bring myself in and I say, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that because I've had this experience that's similar or different from what you've experienced. This reciprocity is baked hardwired into our brain. And one of the things that we know, there's a story in the book about this thing called the Fast Friends Protocol, where these two researchers would bring strangers into a room, two by two, and they would give them a list of 36 questions to ask and answer back and forth. And they were deep questions. And some of them were things like, you know, if you could invite anyone to a dinner party, who would you invite? And some of them were things like, when's the last time you cried in front of another person? Right? So there's a real wide range there. And what they found is that if people went back and forth answering those questions, at the end of it, they felt incredibly close to each other. Even though they were strangers, they felt like they knew each other, they understood each other. They would go hunt each other down once the experiment was over and have a beer together. One couple ended up getting married who met through this experiment.
I love the fact that 57% of them stayed in touch with each other.
Yeah,
just this extraordinary thing, actually, to put strangers together and yet... And a majority of the group found such a bond that they wanted to make it enduring.
And this is pre-internet, right? So, like, there was one guy who they talked to who said, you know, I didn't know my partner's name. I knew that it was, like, John S. So I called every John S. in the phone book until I found the right one. Yeah. They went out of their way. Now, what's interesting is they did this experiment again, and instead of having people go back and forth and instead of having this reciprocity, they would have one person answer all 36 questions while the other person listened, and then the second person would answer all 36 questions. Didn't work at all.
Oh, wow.
They didn't feel close in the slightest. It's the reciprocity that actually connects us.
I'm really intrigued with the applications of this for any of us thinking about trying to create a cohesive team, a cohesive group, because I guess there's a danger if it's done wrong, it'll feel like manipulation. If a leader turns up and they say, I've got these 35 questions, so we're gonna spend our team offsite all answering these questions about each other. So people might feel like, yeah, I don't want to get into that. And so it raises really interesting questions about trying to diagnose what would feel like a good area to explore, what would feel like might be going too far. it's really interesting thinking about the application because it's so potent that making sure that it doesn't feel like manipulation is a really important nuance.
And I think the thing is that in order for it not to feel like manipulation, it has to feel authentic, yeah. Right? So if I bring all my team into a meeting, into a offsite, and we're fighting with each other and we don't like each other, and I'm say, let's do these 36 questions. Clearly, that's not an authentic desire for people to get to know each other. That's me trying to force everyone into alignment. And so a much better thing to do is to say, look, there's something that's separating us from each other. And here's one way that we might be able to get over it, right? And I think that's what changes something from being manipulative to being genuine, is when we say, I'm inviting you, not mandating you, I'm inviting you to be a participant in this conversation. And by virtue of the fact that I've invited you, you can decline. You can turn me down. And if you do, that's okay. But at least we have a tool at that point.
One of the things that I was pleased to see a data point on is the idea of listening being related to psychological safety. One of the constant refrains in the world of work is the idea of psychological safety. And the perennial question is, but how do I create it? And one of the things that comes out of the book is you say that actually one of the biggest creations of psychological safety is someone feeling listened to.
Absolutely.
Because they feel like they're expressing something that's true to them, that's a feeling to them, and someone is reciprocating, potentially a boss or a colleague, is reciprocating by listening to what they're saying.
That's exactly right.
And I think this is so often overlooked. People might be looking for something more active when it comes to creating psychological safety, or they'll perceive listening as a passive action.
Yeah, and it isn't, right? This is the interesting thing about listening, is that if I'm listening to you, even if I'm listening closely, you might not know that I am listening to you, right? In fact, there's probably, particularly if we're having a tense conversation, there's probably a little part in the back of your brain which is wondering if I'm being quiet because I'm merely waiting my turn to speak as opposed to listening to you. And so there's a technique for proving that we're listening. And it's a technique that we exercise after someone stops speaking. And it's known as looping for understanding. And what looping for understanding does is it has three steps. Step one is usually you ask a question, you know, like, tell me what you're thinking about this, hopefully a deep question. Step two is to repeat back in your own words what you just heard the person say. And step three, and this is the step that most people forget, is ask if you got it right. And if you do that, what you're doing is you're not only listening to someone, you're proving to them, you're demonstrating to them that you're listening. And this changes entirely the conversation. This is how we create psychological safety. In the book, there's the story of this experiment that was done with gun control activists in the United States and gun rights advocates, right? People who owned 45 or 50 guns and people who thought guns should be illegal. And these people, they all knew each other. They had screamed at each other for years across picket lines and on the floors of legislatures. And so these researchers, they bring them together and they say, look, our goal here is not to have you guys like agree on anything. Our goal is not even for you to find common ground. We just want to see if it's possible to have a civil conversation. And we're going to teach you this technique, looping for understanding before you start talking to each other. And so they teach the technique and then the conversations begin. And I talked to people who had participated and they said things like, it was amazing, right? This guy who owns 45, you know, weapons, to have him show so clearly that he wants to understand what I'm saying. He wants to understand why I feel the way I do. It made me feel so safe with him. And it made me want to listen to him. Like, I wanted to understand why he sees things differently. And ultimately, this is the goal of conversation. It is not to convince each other of anything. It is not to prove that I'm right and you're wrong. The goal of a conversation is simply to understand each other. And you might walk away still disagreeing with each other, but if you've achieved that understanding, if you've achieved that sense of psychological safety from talking to someone, then it's a huge success.
One thing I found really helpful was the framework of trying to think about what a conversation we're actually in. And it seems like quite often the breakdowns in communications are when one person feels like they're having a they're venting, and another person feels like they're in a negotiation.
Right.
And we've not necessarily diagnosed what's going on. And you make this lovely reductive summarization of whether someone wants to be hugged, helped, or heard.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I put them in the right order, but helped, hugged, or heard. And it was really helpful for me because I think you say 70% of conversations, people just want to be heard or they're social.
Yeah.
But it was a really interesting framework. I just wonder if you could unpack it for us.
Absolutely.
So what are those three different states?
Well, and the way that I came to this was that I got into a bad pattern with my wife where I would come home from work and I would start complaining about my day, right? Like my boss is a jerk. And my wife very reasonably would offer some good advice. She would say something like, why don't you take your boss out to lunch? You guys can get to know each other better. And instead of being able to hear what she was saying, I would get even more upset, right? I would say things like, you know, why aren't you outraged on my behalf? You're supposed to be on my side on this. And then she would get upset because I was attacking her for giving me good advice. And so I went and I talked to researchers and I asked them, like, what's going on here? Like, my wife and I have been married for 20 years. Why do we keep falling into this pattern? And they said, well, here's what we've learned in the last decade. Most people think of a discussion as being about one thing, right? We're talking about our day, or we're talking about our kids' grades, or we're talking about where we're going to go on holiday next year. But actually, every discussion is made up of different kinds of conversations. And they tend to fall into one of three buckets. There are these practical discussions where we're trying to solve problems or come up with plans. Then there's emotional conversations where I might tell you how I'm feeling and I don't want you to solve my feelings. I want you to empathize with me. And then there's social conversations, which is about how we relate to each other and how we, the social identities that are important to us. And they said, what we've learned is if you're not having the same kind of conversation at the same moment, it's really hard to hear each other. So when you came home from work, you were having an emotional conversation. You were talking about how upset you were because it was a bad day. And your wife was having a practical conversation, and both of those are legitimate conversations. But because it's not the same kind of conversation at the same moment, you can't hear each other.
And just having that framework actually helps you, in my experience, work out, oh, this is why there's a disconnect here.
Yeah.
And so I've been able to say, I'm not looking for advice, I was just giving you a perspective on, and actually just sort of labeling what I was looking for from that.
Do you find, are you married?
Yeah.
Yeah, do you find, so how does this play out with your wife? Do you guys ever?
Most definitely. Normally our discourse, I mean, I think you characterize good relationships, there's often joking or there's often, and we have all of that there, but most definitely these times where one of us is venting and the other, you know, I naturally go into solving mode or I think it's very easy actually. When someone gives you a situation, you're like, okay, well, let's resolve that and move on. Sometimes neglecting the fact that someone just wants to unburden themselves.
Yeah. And in fact, that's what my wife and I do now. Like if I start complaining, my wife, Liz, will say, you know, do you want me to solve this problem with you? Or do you just need to get this off your chest? Do you just need to vent? And it's actually great when she asks that. It makes me feel so good because it shows that A, she wants to actually help me, but B, sometimes I haven't stopped to ask myself that question. And when she asks, I can say like, oh, no, it's not that big a deal. I'm just frustrated right now, but it's not something that's like that big a deal. And it's very helpful. Oftentimes when people help us understand what we want from a conversation, what they're really doing is they're helping us figure out how to be in that conversation.
The first part of the book I found really helpful as a field guide for improving things. But there was real power in the discussion about social identities and teams. Not least because I think a lot of leaders are finding, a lot of team members now are finding that lack of cohesiveness. And it felt like one of the things you talk about the importance of is having a who are we discussion. Mm-hmm. And it felt like a lot of groups, a lot of teams don't have that who are we discussion.
Yeah.
And so as a result, they feel atomized and disconnected. I just wonder if you could give us a sense of the importance of who are we conversations and what that sense of shared identity enables us to do.
Oh, absolutely. It's critical, right? You mentioned psychological safety. One of the things we know that's a hallmark of psychological safety is I feel like I can bring my whole self to work. So if my whole self includes the fact that I'm an immigrant from India, and you know I learned English as my second language, or you know, or I I'm gay or I'm straight or I'm black or I'm white. These different social identities, or I'm a conservative or I'm a liberal. We oftentimes try to shy away from these identities in conversations. We like to pretend like differences don't exist. But the truth of the matter is, the differences sometimes explain who we are. Right? I couldn't have a conversation with you and know nothing about your background and know nothing about the what you hope, and the fact that you're married tells me something about how you carry yourself through the world. And so these social identities are really, really critical. And having conversations where we invite people to talk about their social identities is essential. But you have to do it the right way, right? Because we all know how hard it can be to, if someone says, okay, we're going to talk about racism now, and let's all go around and talk about, you know, how we're going to be anti-racist. There are some people who might be put off by that or might feel threatened by that. And so the key is to have conversations where we don't just welcome one social identity to the table, we welcome all of your social identities to the table. Because the truth of the matter is, you and I, we are both white men, but you're also a former business person, right? And you're running a podcast, and you are married, and you might have kids, and you might volunteer with your local police department, and you might be a gardener. All these different identities, when we bring them all to the table, what we do is we avoid pushing each other into just one stereotype. If I say, you're the white guy at the table, tell me about racism, like how are you responsible for racism? You suddenly feel completely threatened, right? Like I'm the one who has to solve racism. But if I bring all of your identities to the table and I bring all of my identities to the table and I create space for all of us to talk, then what I'm doing is I'm giving us a chance to explain who we really are, how we want to relate to each other. Because oftentimes, we want to be closer to each other, and we're not certain how to do it.
There was a lovely example of soccer teams, football teams in Iraq that sort of helped use those things, which was a beautiful articulation of, I guess, how you can overcome some of the prejudices that might exist. Could you just talk us through that story?
Yeah, this is a great experiment, and thank you for asking. I love this experiment. A researcher from Stanford went to Iraq, and she set up a new soccer league. And this was in a town where there was a large Christian majority and a Muslim minority. And there had been soccer teams before, but all the soccer teams had been Christian soccer teams. Muslims were not allowed on the soccer teams. And there was a lot of strife between the Christian population and the Muslim population. For instance, there were Christian grocery stores and Muslim grocery stores and Christian restaurants and Muslim restaurants. And there would actually be bouncers who would check your ID, which listed your religion. And so what they did is they came in and they said, look, we're going to start a brand new soccer league, and we're going to get you new uniforms, and we're going to get new trophies, really, really nice trophies. But the deal is half the teams have to let us add 3 more players, and those 3 players are going to be Muslim. And then they sit back to see what happens. And for the first couple of weeks, you know, the Muslim players show up and the Christian players show up, and they don't mix at all, right? They in fact, the Christians would speak this language that was not Arabic, because they knew that the Muslims couldn't understand it. And initially, it was very hard because that was their identities. They were Muslim or they were Christian. But there was a rule that they had instituted for the league, which is that everyone has to get equal playing time. And once they got equal playing time, they started assigning roles to people, right? You know, Masood, you are the center, but you're also the guy who brings the juice for us during practices. You, Muhammad, you're the guy you're going to play goalkeep, but in addition, you're the guy who's going to do all the warm-up stretches with us before we start. And they start assigning everyone roles. And what happens is that over time, the salience of those roles becomes stronger than the salience of their religious differences. And they start spending more time together, they start talking together, they start all speaking Arabic, and they come together as a group. And the question is, why? Why did these two groups that were otherwise opposed to each other, why did they become friends? Why were they able to play together? And the answer is because oftentimes the identities, particularly the social identities that put us apart from each other, they're dependent on the salience of the environment. And if I take an environment and I say, look, this is an environment where there's Muslims and there's Christians, then it's not surprising that they're not going to mix. But if I say, this is an environment where we have team A and team B, and what really matters is winning the game, not how you pray, then over time, people begin to align with each other. They begin to downplay their differences. And this is what's important in a business setting, right? Is that when we have a team that needs to bond with each other, when we have a team that has differences, how do we take those differences and acknowledge them and recognize them, but not make them the most salient thing on the table? How do we find the salient issues that help us bond with each other? Which could be as simple as, look, we're all in this to like sort of hit our sales numbers, right? Or we're all doing this because we want our company to change the world. That's what matters, is finding what to emphasize when we're trying to bring people together so that their social identities become more or less important.
I felt the importance of that was especially, as you've articulated there, it's not erasure. It's actually making sure that everyone recognizes each other's individual social identities, but that forms the basis of then a trusting relationship that then creates this new social identity, which is
exactly
we are
right.
This team together.
And because the truth of the matter is you're not going to erase social identities, right? If we're sitting at a table and most of us are white and one person's black, it's not as if he's going to forget that he's black. Mm. If we have teams of Christians and Muslims, nobody's going to forget that they're Christians and Muslims. The question then becomes, how do we make that difference less important, and how do we find other similarities and make them more important? That's how we recognize and acknowledge and accept and embrace our differences without it becoming a barrier to us connecting with each other.
Just changing tone a little bit, one of the things that we're finding increasingly now is that, who could put a number on it, but a lot of our communication happens through a screen or through devices.
Yeah.
And I just wonder to what extent that requires adaptations. How do we need to think about these things differently? I posed that question before, and maybe we could kick off with that. That organization that said that all of their communication was cameras off. Now, it strikes me as an incredibly impoverished way to try and build connections with other people. But I guess if it's become a norm in their organization because no one has articulated the benefit of doing something more full.
And can I ask you, what was their theory behind saying cameras off?
Broadly, I think these things come from an over-scheduled world. There might have been a time and a place where maybe if we had 3 or 4 or 5, 6 hours a week of meetings and they were all face-to-face, that we could get these things done. But as organizations, I dealt with one organization before Christmas and they told me they had 40 hours a week of meetings on average.
Gosh.
And I said, wow. They said some of them had meetings in the evenings, some of them had over 40 hours. And I said, when did you get your work done? And they said, oh yeah, well, we all cameras off. We do our work in the meetings. I was like, okay, well, back to that George Bernard Shaw quotation, communication, the biggest problem with communication is the illusion it took place. No one's communicating there. They're sort of merely keeping one eye on something that's going on.
That's exactly right.
And so this company that I think had gone to cameras off, it was just a more comfortable way for them to deal with this onslaught of communication. And I'd love your informed take on the rights and wrongs of those things and how to cope with them, really.
Well, so it's interesting because one of the things that we know is our brains have evolved to be so good at communication, right? So we can adapt to new forms of communication. One of my favorite examples of this is that about 100 years ago, when telephones first became popular, there were all these studies saying, oh, people will never be able to have real conversations on a telephone because you can't see each other, right? And what's interesting is that at that moment, they were right. If you look at the transcripts of those early telephone conversations, people used them like telegrams. They would just, they use them to like send grocery orders or stock trades. Now, of course, by the time you and I were in high school and everyone who's listening, we could talk for like 7 hours a night on the phone, right? And they were some of the most important conversations of our life. And what happens is that when we use a new form of communication, we learn how to use that form of communication. We learn how to embrace it and how to make it part of our life. So if we look at how our kids communicate on their phones, they send each other emojis, they send each other like little like texts. Our kids have learned that different forms of communication have different rules. And when we get into trouble is when we forget to remind yourself about those rules. When we forget to say, okay, look, a text is different from an email, is different from a face-to-face conversation. Because face-to-face, if I'm being sarcastic, you can hear the sarcasm in my voice. But when I'm typing you an email, I can hear the sarcasm, but you can't hear it. So you get upset because you think I'm being serious in what I'm writing you. So what's really important here is to use technology deliberately and then to recognize what the rules are for various forms of technology and to remind ourselves. Rather than assuming that a Zoom meeting with cameras on is the same as a Zoom meeting with cameras off, to say, look, there's a difference here. And sometimes cameras off might be appropriate and sometimes cameras on might be appropriate as well. But there's a difference here. There's slightly different rules. And we need to acknowledge those rules and abide by them if we really want to connect with each other.
Talk us through the title, The Super Communicators, because I think at one stage you talk about something which feels adjacent to like the idea of a charismatic leader as someone who is able to have multiple conversations to connect groups. And I just love, firstly, a discussion about the title and secondly, about what you're feeling about that sort of charismatic leader. Or are there some people who hold groups together by the force of their communication skills?
So it's interesting because when I first started working on this book, I thought that super communicators would be people who had a bunch of charisma or they were extroverts or they were kind of the life of the party. And it turns out that's not true at all, right? Super communicators come from all walks of life and there's no personality characteristic that seems determinant about whether someone becomes a super communicator. It's just entirely whether they learn a set of skills. And if you learn those skills, then you can use them. You can use these tools to connect with almost anyone. And it's an interesting question, like who are super communicators? And the way that I usually describe it is to say, if you were having a bad day and you wanted to call someone who you know would make you feel better, like you just give them a ring and they're going to pick you up, does someone pop into your mind?
Yeah.
Who is it?
A couple of my friends. Okay. I've got a friend who sort of probably knows everything from like the ins and outs of my life to actually my obsession with tennis. And so if we just want a diversionary conversation, or if we want, so yeah, there's sort of a couple of obvious people who spring
to mind. For you, he's probably a super communicator and you're probably a super communicator back to him. Now, there are some people who can do this with almost anyone, right? There are some people who can be consistent super communicators. They can connect with almost anyone anytime they want to. And my guess is, and tell me if I'm getting this wrong, my guess is that when you call that friend, one of the reasons that you enjoy talking to him is because he asks you the right questions. You know that he's listening to you. He somehow shows you that he really cares, that he wants to understand. Those are just skills that we can learn. And when we do, we can use them with anyone. Because sometimes we want to connect with people and we feel like we can't, right? We want to connect and there's just something between us. But super communicators, consistent super communicators, they've learned how to connect with really anyone. And it's just because they've learned a couple of tools that they can use, like asking deep questions, like looping for understanding and showing someone that I'm listening to them. These are the things that help us really connect.
It really strikes me that my instinct when I read through it and when I put it into practice, that I feel like, oh yeah, this is definitely learnable. This is definitely a teachable skill.
Yeah.
And you seem to be endorsing that idea.
Oh, absolutely.
All of us can get better at this.
Absolutely. I mean, and again, communication is Homo sapiens' superpower, right? Communication is the thing that has let our species be such a success. It's let us build villages and families and communication is something that we are born to do. And sometimes we just need to be reminded of how to do it, to let those habits and those instincts and that desire come out. But the nice thing is anyone can learn to do it. This is not something magical. This is not something you're born doing. This is not something that just charismatic leaders can do. We can all connect with other people if we just know a couple of principles about how to make that connection easier.
Looking back now to the time that you were a manager and you didn't feel like you'd done it well, are there any bits of advice that you would give your former self?
Oh, yeah. To oh, do my gosh.
Better?
I mean, honestly, the number one thing I would do is I would tell myself to ask more questions and to listen more closely and show that I'm listening. Because at the end of the day, all the mistakes I made were because I assumed I knew what was going on. I assumed I knew what this person wanted. I assumed that that I had found the right solution. And instead of asking people, tell me what you need. Tell me what you want. Tell me what's going on. Tell me why you're upset. If I had just asked more questions, and if I had just listened more closely, and if I had shown them that I was listening more closely, it would have changed everything.
I think, and the discipline you say of checking that you understood and getting that confirmation is probably something that a lot of leaders might learn to ask a few questions, but they're not really backing it up with the intensity of listening and the intensity of confirmation.
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of it is, and that's why things like looping for understanding, repeating back what I hear you say, asking if I got it right, that's why that's so powerful, is because sometimes I want to listen to you, but I get in my own way, right? You say something and then I start arguing in my own head about what I'm going to say in response. But if my job in this conversation is just to listen closely enough to you that I can repeat back what you're saying in a way that you say, yeah, you got it right. If my job in this conversation is not to convince you of anything, it's not even necessarily to agree on anything. My only job in this conversation is to understand you, understand what you're saying to me, and to speak in a way that you can understand me, then that's so much easier, right? That means that this conversation is a success, even if we don't convince each other of anything, even if we walk away disagreeing with each other. It's a success because we connected with each other, because we understand a little bit more. And that understanding, that becomes the foundation that does allow us to start building something together. But it makes the conversation so much easier because I don't have to do anything except listen closely and try and understand and try and authentically explain what I'm seeing and thinking and feeling.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I thought the book was sensational.
Thank you.
You're going to have a hard job selling as much as your previous book, but
yeah, it's true.
But it's most definitely a wonderful follow up.
So. Oh well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you to Charles. Really grateful for that. Honestly, I adored that book, and I try and go out of my way not to say that if I didn't enjoy a title, but that one I really did. I'd definitely be returning to it time and time again. There's a few notes in the show notes if you're interested in some of the details or a link to the book or details on what we discussed. Really grateful for your company today. If you enjoyed this, please do share it with others. I've been Bruce Daisley. See you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.